Oh, I'm so pleased I've done that. That is me just lopping a bit off my family tree. So you may or may not remember, but last week I was suffering from a bit of post-tree mishap trauma because I'd realised that my, I think it's my four-toes great-granny, her surname is Evanson, not Dickin. So this meant I had to lop a bit off my tree. And I was feeling, it took me about 10 days, a bit more, to kind of get round to the idea that this old Ma Dickin wasn't my ancestor. I'd had it wrong for probably over a decade. So I did it. And then once I'd done it, I was like, what was that a fuss about? That was easy to chop it off. But then I went on family search because I thought, right, I better chop it off. I've chopped it off my ancestry tree. I better chop her off my family search tree. And then I discovered all these cool little bits of evidence I'd found that her actual name was Dickin, and maybe I was right all along. So now I'm just so confused.
Right.
I just have to sort myself out.
That's confusing. I was just going to ask you, like, if you have chopped it off, have you just deleted all your research? But I guess that answers that.
No, I was very, being a cautious person, what I did on Ancestry, I undid the relationship between my known ancestors and the one where I got in a pickle, the one where I thought, you're not probably not mine anymore. You can just remove the relationship. So you have your great big tree. And when you look at your main tree, you can't see them attached because you've removed the relationship. So they're not attached to the tree anymore, but they're still there. So imagine if you had a big sack and you've built a great big Lego tree and you've put the beautiful big Lego tree into the sack and then you just take off one brick. So the brick is in the sack. So it's still in your tree, but she's not attached to the rest of the tree.
Okay, cool. So you still got her.
So if I decide that actually she is related, I could just tag her all back in again.
So obviously originally you thought that this was part of your tree.
Mm.
What's caused you to believe it's not? And then now you've just said you think it is again, maybe. Where's the grey area?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So what caused me to think that I got it wrong is when I eventually ordered my three times great granny's birth certificate and it had this different woman's name on. Then I thought I'd better look a bit further into this mystery woman. I didn't even like to feel of her as my ancestor, this Mrs. Evanson. I still don't call her my four times great granny. She's just called Mrs. Evanson. And I'm a bit remote and I'm a bit cold hearted towards her so far. I haven't brought her into the bosom of my family tree yet. So then one of the really cool things with family history is if you're not quite sure that the people are adding up properly is to look at what the siblings are. So imagine, if you're just finding one person by one name, you may or may not get it right. So I thought, right, I'm going to look at all this person's siblings and all of them have Mrs. Evanson as the mum. And I'm like, oh, it is Mrs. Evanson. Mrs. Evanson is the mum. So then I was happy, went to Ancestry, lopped the old mother off and left her as the loose Lego brick in the bag next to my tree. Because I thought, she's related somehow. The names tie in too well.
Mm.
But then it was when I went to, so that was happy and good. Nice. Do you understand so far?
Yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah. And the sibling thing was really, really handy. But then I went up to my family search tree and I realised I had actually got six different sources. So six bits of evidence saying that Mary Ann Dickins' name was Mary Ann Dickins. I'm like, ooh, it wasn't just like a little passing fancy. I actually had done a bit of research there.
Right.
So
you'd forgotten that you'd done that amount of research.
Yes, because now I'm a new and improved family historian and I keep a research log and I've done this for probably about 5 years, maybe a bit longer, not much longer. So I write down everything I do. But this research is back. The latest, last time I worked on it, on the family search tree was in 2016. So that was when I was still a Wild West Cavalier researcher who didn't write anything down.
Just doing anything.
So now I'm going to have to go through it all. This is why you need to write it down, because I've caused myself all this headache and faff and time waste and confusion. And if I'd just written it down, I could go back to my old research notes and go, oh, you concluded X, Y, and Z because of X, Y, and Z. Now I just have these mystery documents. I don't know what they mean and how they stack up because I didn't.
Okay.
Just a little pile of paper with no train of thought.
Right, yeah, that all kind of makes sense to me from results.
So learn from me. Don't do what I did. Yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah, it's cool. I'll have fun sorting it out. I'll definitely have fun sorting it out.
It's gonna be interesting to see which way it goes as well. Like, obviously, like you say, if you've got six sources, that does sound pretty solid, doesn't it? So where does the discrepancy come then? It's just in that one record where the surname's different.
I don't know. I've decided what I need to do next. So there's this guy called Phil Isherwood, and he's super organized, and he advocates, if you're in a pickle, get good old Excel. You don't need any fancy software, just get Excel and literally write an effectively like a shopping list of all the info you found out about your ancestor who's confusing you. And you put it into Excel, sort it into date order, and then you can see kind of problems will get thrown up. So it could be that I'm conflating two people, and maybe this husband did have a Mary Dickin wife, maybe he had a Mary Evanson wife. So maybe Mary Dickin came along later and she's like, right. Mum, all of it's possible, isn't it? I just don't know yet because of my rubbish lack of notes. But with using Phil Isherwood's plan and then writing this shopping list, putting it into date order, I'll be able to see who was where when. And if I'm finding I've got there's a Mary Ann Everson somewhere and a Mary Ann Dickin at the same time, I can gradually build evidence to go, perhaps these are two different people, or maybe they're consecutive women in this household. So like a first wife and then a second wife. Now I gradually help myself sort out all these facts, take them from being a jumble to a nice orderly list.
Yeah, that sounds logical as well.
It's nice and logical, yeah. So anyway, Nathan, how have you got on with your family history this week?
Okay, I've done my homework. Did I say last time I'd sent my DNA off? I have.
Yeah.
I sent my DNA off. I've not had anything back on that yet. It doesn't look like they've even got it. I've downloaded the Ancestry app and you can check the progress of your DNA. And it doesn't look like the lab's even got it yet. So we're relying on the postal service there. What would happen if it goes missing? That's an interesting one. Would they willingly send you another one out, or because it's registered number?
Yes, I suspect they would, because by chance we had a DNA club meeting yesterday and Donna Rutherford was talking about this, because you're supposed to leave a certain amount of time, about 30 minutes between taking your DNA test, between eating and taking your DNA test. So, you know, occasionally people mess it up and the lab can't get a good, clear reading of somebody's DNA results. And apparently in the cases where they can't get a good, clear reading, then they just send you out a new kit. And the reason is because that little cardboard box with the little tiny plastic vial of, what do you call it? You know, the keeping solution, keeping solution. You know, that's cheap kit. The reason why the kit is expensive is because of all the processing in the lab and the storings of the samples and all of that sort of stuff. So they probably would just send you out a new one, because you're not good. It's not like anyone could get into scam mode and keep saying, I've lost it, because
you're going to get the same results every time.
You're going to get yourself identified as a criminal anyway, because your name would keep hopping up with all these different people's DNA if you kept doing that and giving them out to your friends. So I'm pretty sure they would just honour it and send you out a new one.
Cool. Nothing to worry about there then. That's good.
Nothing about. It's going to be a busy time of year because there's these deals around at the moment. So probably lots of people are ordering, and it's...
Definitely. And obviously the postal service is only going to get busier and busier with the festive period upon us. But yeah, rest of my homework I've done. I downloaded the Ancestry app, went onto the tree, and I have put in from both my mum's side and my dad's side all the way back to my great, great grandparents.
That is fantastic.
I'm amazed I've stopped there. It's instantly quite addictive, like the way it creates a tree and like the connections and all this stuff. It's terrifying how much I'm going to get addicted to that, I think. Yeah. I don't know what half of it means though. Like within like about half an hour of doing it, I had a bunch of leaves appear on loads of people's names, like in the top corner. And then I've got one guy who's flashing, like his image is not image, I haven't put any images in, but like his little logo's flashing. I don't know what that means. But yeah, so that all happened. So I pressed on one of the leaves and a picture of my granddad's gravestone came up, which is amazing and terrifying at the same time. It's like, wow. So people have been researching my family line and it's in there.
Mm.
but I've not taken out a subscription or a trial, so it won't let me go too far with that.
Mm.
Clearly, I'm going to have to though, because there's loads of stuff coming up.
They probably are, and all of that bodes really well that other people are researching your branches, because then when you get your DNA test results back, hopefully some of them will have done DNA tests as well. Even if they haven't, if it's going to anything which is going to help you build out your tree, that will be helpful for you identifying your DNA matches. But hopefully some of them have, as I say, have done a test, and then you'll be able to connect with them that way.
Cool. And like with these images, I've not gone into it too much, because it started just getting like baffling. Loads of like records started coming up and images that people had taken. I clicked on one of the images and it said to me, do I want to get a subscription to the service? If I did, could I then add that image to my tree?
Yes.
Yes. And if I stopped my subscription, would that image still remain?
As far as I know, this is a good point. I don't know about with people's personal photos. So what I do know about is this. So let's say you take out a subscription to Ancestry, you find some census records that relate to your ancestors, you add them to your family tree. Some point in the future, you stop subscribing to Ancestry, you'll still be able to access your tree. But when you try and view the documents, then they will be kind of pixelated out. You won't be able to see them properly. So when you do find documents on Ancestry that you like, then if you want to keep permanent access to them, what you need to do is download them to your computer. So on the app, from memory, it's not so obvious. But when you go on the desktop, if you go up in the top right-hand corner, when you found this, for instance, a census document, you know, have a few different options like save to your shoebox, save to your tree, save to your computer. And if you put save to your computer, set up a folder there, then you've got them for safekeeping. When it comes to people's personal photos that they've added, i.e. things which aren't part of the official Ancestry collections of records that have been licensed from archives and things like that, I don't know what the answer is. I would probably play it safe, not be frustrated, and download it to your computer. Mm. When I download photos from Ancestry, from other Ancestry users, so you know, pictures of great-grandpa's graves and pictures of great-great-aunties, that sort of thing, I do always put the username as part of the file name. I do add their name into the file name, and the reason is to remind myself where I got the image from, partly because I might want to get back to that person and make contact with them, and partly just so that I can remain cautious how I use the image, i.e. I wouldn't upload the image to my own family history website. I think you'd be perfectly entitled to do that. I would just feel a bit rude to do that without asking the person first. I just would put them a line and go, hey, I'd love to use your photo on my website.
Good etiquette then, basically, just...
Yeah, I think it's me just being a conflict avoider, so I want to try and be super cautious. Okay. As per the terms and conditions of Ancestry, I think people understand that if you upload a family photo to Ancestry, other people will use it and can use it as they wish. I think that's the idea. I haven't read the terms and conditions for a while, but I think that's still the situation.
Yeah, well, like literally this gravestone has like four names on it that I have literally input on my see already. So it's like, it's definitely the right one. And then obviously... It instantly makes sure that all those names are right. So that's quite cool to see.
Yes, it is. And that's a bit like the sibling thing I was saying. Having that cross-checking of lots of names makes you feel really confident. Because if you just had a gravestone with Harry Smith on it, you'd be like, it's probably my grandpa, but I'm not really sure. And, you know, the dates tally, but you still might not feel confident. Whereas the more information you can cross-refer, the more confident you are. This is definitely my people.
Yeah, definitely. It's like, obviously I'm using my mum's family tree stuff as my basis, so a lot of, well, pretty much everything I've put in on my Ancestry family tree has come from her, and I've not done any fact checking, but instantly within 1 second of seeing this gravestone, it's like, yeah, those names are right. And it did make me feel good. It's like, oh yeah, I'm on track here. And already I've found, like, even going back to the wherever I got back to, there's information missing already. There's like a lack of knowledge about the day of death and stuff like that. So there's stuff for me to research. And I'm like, I want to fill those gaps in already, because it's like the completionist in me is like, oh man, that's missing. I need to get that. So
So that's quite potentially quite easy for you to sort out. So if it's your great-great-grandparents, then I don't know when they would have died, but it probably a century ago would be kind of reasonable.
Mm.
So you could look in two different places. You can look in the civil registers, and you could look in church registers as well, church burial registers. So the first thing I'd recommend probably is to go on Family Search or look within Ancestry, Find My Past, look and see if there's a local family history society that's got the burial registers and try and see if they're listed anywhere and you can get a burial date for them. Because potentially you can get the information. You'd need your ancestry description, but Family Search will be free of charge. Your local family history society, they made you look up what tends to happen. You need to join as a member to join the family history society that covers the Pudsey area. It's not very expensive. It's probably like £10 or £15 a year. And then what else? Yeah, Find My Past has really good parish register collections, because then for not much money, you can get it. The other option is to look in the civil register. So you go to the gro.certificates website, look in the death indexes, and I think it's only £2.50, and you can download a little digital copy of their death register entry. So that's pretty cool, isn't it?
Yeah, it's good.
It's really good. When you're searching on there, if I haven't looked for a death for ages, but when you're searching for births, you can only look for the year plus or minus 2 years. So it's worth trying to gauge what the death year is before you head to the GRO site. Otherwise, you've got a faffy search just to keep going in those 5 year increment scheme.
Okay, great. Yeah. A lot of the ones that I've got bits missing for seem to be I've got the year, but not a date at all.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
But I mean, equally, there's question marks next to that. So maybe it's not even correct, but it feels like a solid date at the moment. Well, a solid year, should I say?
Yes. Yes. And with a solid year, let's say they died in 1921, if it's always worth searching the early bit of 1922, because imagine it's the end of the year. Imagine they died in the last week of the year. And I think people have 5 or so days to register a death. So if it went over that, if you're not finding them in the year you suspect, check just a little bit afterwards. And that goes for births as well, because people are allowed 6 weeks to register a birth.
Okay, yeah, just to make it slightly more challenging for everybody. That's cool.
So when you were building your ancestry tree, how did you find it? Did it feel like slick and easy, or were you having to use all the cogs in your brain? What was it like?
It was fairly straightforward. Obviously, when you start putting like one path in, it takes you down that path. So I put my dad's name in first, and then instead of putting my mum's name in, it asked me to put my granddad's name in. So I'm following that path down. And then I was a little panicked that, oh, how did I get back to the start to actually do it? But I soon found that out. It was quite freaky though. Like I said, like within minutes of doing it, suddenly these little leaves appear, and I wasn't like learning how to do it at all. I was literally just inputting data, and then things started flashing at me, and I was like, oh my God, what's going on? And like, even now I've got one flashing. What does that mean? Why is there a guy flashing on my...
I haven't ever noticed somebody flashing. I'm going to have a look now and see if I can see a flashing person. Sounds rude.
It does. It's like pulsing at the top of the family tree. So they're all like great.
I had to encourage you to enter something there. No, I haven't got any pulsing people.
Wait, stop now.
Let me look on my app. That's just looking on my laptop. I think it might be trying to be a prompt to get you to add the next person.
Right. Wanting me to follow that track. Right.
Yes, I have said no flashing people. So the little green leaf, they're just called shaky leaves or hints.
Yep.
And yeah, they can be fun. They can be useful. You need to watch out, because sometimes the more you get to know your family, the more you can be really confident of a hint. So the hints can be fantastic for helping you find out new records that you might not have ever thought to look for. Maybe occupational records you might not have thought to look for, that sort of thing. Or family photos. But then sometimes you'll get complete curveballs and you think, this is not related to my family. So you do, it's up to you. Remember, they're called a hint. They're not called, here's a guaranteed piece of evidence for your tree. It's a hint. So you have to assess it.
The one for my granddad, there was three different people put a gravestone on, and then there was a register. Let's have a look, actually, whilst I'm here. Yeah, England and Wales Civil Register 1916 to 2005 married. Oh, that's the marriage index. Then a 1939 West Riding. I don't know what that is. Lots of documents that I don't have a clue what they mean. So
yes, these are all cool. So both those records that you've mentioned, they're both accurate government records. So the first one's a marriage index, and the second one's the 1939 register, which I'll waffle about in a minute. It's such a cool record. So the problem isn't that the records are pie in the sky. It's whether that record with that Harry Smith on, or whatever the name is your Harry Smith. That's because they will have dragged up a record from official government records about a Harry Smith, but you need to make sure, is it your Harry Smith?
Okay.
Yeah.
That's then checking like birth and death and stuff like that. Well, not death.
Yes. Yes. Partly making sure that there's things to... So when a hint gets served up to you, you're getting a piece of information out of the blue, and it's an untethered piece of information. So it's completely the opposite of you going out to search for a piece of information. When you go and search for a piece of information, you'll know how you set your search parameters. So you'll go, I'm searching for Harry Smith in England or in Yorkshire or in Pudsey, and I'm searching for Harry Smith who was born in 1915, give or take 2 years, or Harry Smith born in the 1900s. So you'll have set very precise goals, partly in your head and partly how you fill in the fields. So when you get those search results back, obviously sometimes they do get search results which go beyond what you'd hope. They're a bit too broad. But on the whole, those search results are going to be fitting the bill for what you're after. And maybe you get a list of 3 or 7 people and you have to try and whittle it down to which one's yours. So that's fine, isn't it? Because you can use your brain the whole time to keep analysing.
Yep.
When you get a hint, the algorithm has gone, hey, you got a Harry Smith in your tree and they live in Yorkshire, and this is a Harry Smith who lives in Yorkshire too. And very often it's correct, and pretty often it's incorrect. So it's up to you to do the decision process. But when you find that Harry Smith, unless you've got that familiarity already with your tree, you're not going to know that it's definitely yours, because you're not going to know whether there's 3 other possible contenders or 7 other possible contenders or 91 other possible contenders or any. So it's just gradually an experience thing of getting more and more. We each get our own, become the world leading experts in our own little branches of our own little trees, don't we? So you'll get to know who your guys are.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying don't trust them. I'm just saying, to be fair to Ancestry, they call them hints. They've told us all their hints, and they're really, really useful. But we need to use our heads, and that's fun. It'd be boring if we didn't need to have to use our heads, wouldn't it?
Yeah, definitely. It was very exciting to instantly see these records.
Yes.
Like, even some have come up from my dad, and I'm not sure they're right because some of the locations seem wrong. But it's exciting to think that it has pulled in some documents, and it's like a bit of history that I can start looking through.
Yes, and it's really helpful because, especially when you start out, you don't even know what you could possibly be. Imagine if you've never eaten cake and you went into a cake shop and you weren't allowed to look on what's on the shelf. You wouldn't know which cake to choose. And it's like this. You don't know what the possibilities are yet.
Yeah, it's massive. Like, I keep saying it's big, and it's there's so much to look at. But just in the small amount that I've put on my tree, I'm like, wow, there's so many things to do and click and think about and research. And yeah, it's just big, isn't it? It's bonkers. One thing at a time, I guess.
Yes. That 1939 record that you said, I'm pretty sure, obviously other records can happen in 1939, but in 1939, the big record for England and Wales is the 1939 National Register. So what happened was, we joined the Second World War at the beginning of September, and then through September, the government had passed, like through August, there was all these international kind of war negotiations as war was rumbling on and more countries were joining the war. So, and Britain knew that we were pretty much going to join the war. So by the start of September, everything kicked into action super quick. And I think it was about 1 million children were evacuated. People were called up just onto a war footing within weeks. So by the end of September, what they did, this massive national register, and everybody who wasn't in the military had to have their names, dates of birth, occupations. I think they had any special skills which might be relevant to wartime, and their birthday, their actual birthday, recorded on this register. And there was a high incentive to sign up, because if you didn't sign up, you weren't going to get your ration coupons and your identity card. So if you didn't have your identity card, you couldn't really go anywhere without your ration coupons. You could be as rich as you like, but it'd be pretty hard to get food. So there's a big incentive. So it's a really comprehensive record because people didn't want to dodge out of it because of those reasons. Some people might have wanted to dodge out a little bit initially because obviously you could be called up to fight.
Right.
But it's not renowned for having a poor take-up. It's renowned for having a good take-up. And it was taken in Scotland as well and in Northern Ireland because by the time of the outbreak of the Second World War, Ireland had split into two different parts. But it's much harder to get hold of the 1939 records for Northern Ireland and Scotland. That's not relevant to you, though. Luckily for you, you're looking at Yorkshire Register so far. So you could find this 1939 register once you got your subscription on Ancestry and on Find My Past. And you can actually see the page where your ancestors would have been written up with all their neighbours going down their street. And anyone who has a black line on them, it means they were born within the last 100 years, and the record hasn't been updated to say that they've died. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
But anyone who was born before 2024, they will be visible, definitely visible.
Right.
Not 2024. 1924. Makes my head hurt. Yeah.
Yeah.
Every year they roll on the computer, remove the redaction, remove the black lines from another year's worth of people because they obviously know how old the people are because it's got their birth dates in the records. It's really cool. It's really moving record. I absolutely love it because I just think of, you know, there are many countries which weren't doing very honourable things to their citizens, to say the least, at the time, Europe, whereas we were creating a register. Okay, so we could do call up people to fight, but it was to ensure that people had ration cards. And I've read all the discussions in Hansard, which is transcripts of what they discuss and debate in the House of Commons. And the politicians are saying we need to have ration cards. So in the First World War, we didn't have ration cards, and the black market went sky high, and people were literally apparently starving in England during the First World War because food prices were too high, and they were like, this must not happen again. We mustn't have our population treated this badly. So I'm like, yes, this is really decent behaviour. It's good, isn't it?
Very British.
Yeah, really British. It makes me feel really patriotic. Yeah.
That's cool. A little bit of history.
Yeah. So I guess, what are you going to do next then? You've done so well adding on all those people.
Well, I think knowing who I am, my initial thing is I want to fill in the blanks already of the people that I've put on before, because I know from like looking at my mum's stuff, she has got names that have gone further back, but I feel I want like the proper dates filling in for these earlier people. If I can find them first, it'll just make me feel like I've done something new and exciting that she possibly hasn't. And
it's a really good idea.
Yeah.
So do you know where you're looking for these people? Do you have a rough idea? You've got the rough years. Can you remember any of the years that they?
I'm going to cheat and just look on the app.
Not cheating. That's your record. It's your organised record.
My record, yeah. I've kept it very tidy. So who don't I have? There's so many sides to go through. I don't know which one. Right. I'm not pressing him because he's flashing. Right. We'll go for Phyllis because I want to find out about this Scottish thing. How do I see their entries? Yes, so Phyllis McKay died in 1965, apparently. But that's it. That's all I know.
Okay, so I don't know how late. We can quickly have a look on the GRO website now to find out how late the indexes go. Might get cut off in a minute. Anyway, so the GRO indexes would be a good place for her. That's where you could order a copy of her death register entry, so like her death certificate.
Right.
£2.50, potentially.
Cool.
So that would be good for her. And then if there's anyone earlier, I'd recommend just checking to see whether there are any relevant parish registers and burial registers.
And when you're saying earlier, do you mean born earlier or earlier death?
Both. Yeah, so hopefully if they were born earlier, they died earlier. But obviously some people don't die in order, do they? But
no. The oldest ancestor I've got is, well, was born in 1893.
Hmm.
And they died on the 14th of January in 1943. So we've got an exact date there. Will that just because of wartime, or
no, that's just because
it's just because your mum's done the research.
Your mum's done the research, or your mum's remembered. Also, I can't believe I forgot it. There's this amazing website called freebmd.org.uk. So that is the first place where you should go before faffing around with any of the parish registers and before going off and ordering your £2.50 certificate or whatever. You should go to freebmd because you can look up. That would be my first place. I'd make a list of all the gaps that you've got out of those people that you've added to your tree so far. And if you've got any birth, marriage or death gaps, go to freebmd.org.uk. You're only going to get their register entry, so it'll have a volume number and a page number. Make a note of each one. You can even add it as a note into your ancestry tree, and then gradually you can use that information. Go over to the GRO website, I said, and order the little register copy. And the reason why it's more exciting is when you get the pre-BMD details or the index details, it will just say, I'm always saying Harry Smith, say Harry Smith, volume 8B, page 117, and then it will say the registration district name. So that's all right. But when you get the death certificate, then it will have a cause of death, it will have a precise date of death, it will have an informant, it will have an address. So that's way more clues, isn't it? Getting that death register entry, much more interesting. And you'll see the beautiful old handwriting. We've talked about birth and marriage register entries before, how they have so many more details than just the tiny little index details.
Right, cool. That's exciting.
That's your first job. Do you want a second job? Or I think that's quite a big job, really, to get that accomplished. I think you've done well if you do that.
Yeah, I think that sounds like enough, to be honest.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
Even if you just do one or two of them, it doesn't matter.
Mm.
What would be really good, so you don't do the terrible stuff like me of not writing down why you think things, is so when you find your people, what I think you should do is, say you're searching for Phyllis's death, you should get a Word document or a piece of paper or whatever, or you can write it as a note in her ancestry thing, going what you know at the outset, what you're trying to find out, where you looked. I looked on FreeBMD, I found this. I looked here, I found that. I looked there, I found that. 21st of October or 21st of December or whatever date it is, I ordered her GRO register entry, I cased.
Yeah. That makes sense. So that when I come back to it in years' time, I'll be like, do the same bit of research again in the same place. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, it's a lot to take in. Like, I mean, it's probably really basic, but just seeing the gaps in this small section that I've done is for me personally, it gives me that sort of, I need to complete this. So I've got that going on. All these little hints that you mentioned, I want to press them all and I want to confirm them all. So I want to do that as well. It's something a little bit too addictive about this app. It's drawing me in quite a lot. And then I want to put photographs of people because I know there's like pictures kicking around the house. So I'm going to be asking my mum, who's this, who's that? And
brilliant.
Like, you know, get a face to the names. I think that's actually quite exciting to even think about. I hadn't even thought about it like that, but it'd be great to like, oh, this is Winifred. All right. Now I know who that is. And yeah, that's cool.
That'll be really good. Yes.
But it sounds like I'll be busy if I do all that.
And you will. But as you say, it's fun. And it, as long as you shouldn't be doing something else, it's not a problem. It's okay, isn't it? It's a good use of time.
Yeah, definitely. Out of office hours, of course.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, so I think that's a good goal. I think you've got to fill in your gaps as your priority goal. And then your fun goals is gradually working through adding your documents, and the hints will go on forever. Once you've looked at some hints, more hints will appear. So you're never going to clear.
Oh, right. I'm one of those guys that needs to get rid of red dots that appear on my phone. That's my.
So you can. I sometimes turn my hints off. You can just turn them off. And then when they're not going to go away forever. If you want them back on again, just turn them on again. Because the hints can be a really addictive little rabbit holes, and you just go down them, and then you could end up having finished a research lesson and gone, I wasn't what I meant to do. All I've done is run around after these hints, and what I really wanted to do was something else entirely. So if you find yourself easily distracted, just turn them off. is.
Yeah, well, it's brilliant though, isn't it? Like, literally, I pressed one for my granddad, and obviously, I know my granddad. I've met my granddad. And that, which the one, the 1939 register thing, it's told me that he was an engineer or something. And like, I'd never even thought about his occupation. So I've instantly learned something I didn't know about him. It's
really good.
Mm. Yeah, he was an electrical engineer, a fitter, apparently. So that's cool.
What a useful job to have on the outbreak of a war as well.
Definitely.
It'd be interesting to find out what he actually did during the Second World War. That's another thing for you to do.
Okay, I need to lie down. There's so much to think about.
There is. That's the fun of it.
Right, okay. Right then, enough about me. It's time for reader question time. We had a question come in, Helen. What is a good research methodology for going back 7 generations?
That person, they sound as though they're in a similar position to you, that they just want to do everything all at once. So that it is a good question. It's also a bit of an open-ended question because it depends when the first of those 7 generations started. That would depend which records you're going to look at, and it depends which country they're thinking of researching in. What they're going to do. So they haven't given us any clues about where they're researching or which time period they're researching. And those would be the two key things. If you're starting to do anything, you need to kind of think about what time period you're in, which countries you're searching, because it will depend what things are available to you and depending what records are available to you will determine what steps you take. So the basic methodology for doing any bit of research is, first of all, establish what it is that you already know, then establish what it is that you want to find out. You've heard me say this before, it's like a drill, isn't it? Then establish what it is that you want to find out, write it down, and then the next step is the hard bit, is you need to try and find out what records are available to help you. And so the go-to place if you're stuck, well, there's two go-to places. I'll mention them both. One is go to the National Archives website, so it's discovery.nationalarchives.gov.uk. Go to their research guides, and they have, I won't say a number, it's hundreds of research guides. And they're, some of them are on topics, some of them are based on time periods, some of them are based on specific branches of the armed services, all sorts of things. So go there, find a research guide which is relevant to your topic, and find that will give you lists and examples and links to records that are available, which are going to help you do the researching that you need. And the other place to go to is go to the Family Search Wiki. So yes, go to Family Search, and then I think, I don't know whether you have to log in or not. You try accessing the wiki without logging in. You may be able to, you might have to create an account and log in to access the wiki. I have a feeling you don't need to log in to access the wiki. Go to the wiki, and again, some of the wiki pages are about record types, some of them are about time periods, lots of them are about different places all around the world. So that's why the Family Search Wiki is such a great place for family history, as being a family history launch pad, because however experienced you are, if you suddenly find yourself needing to research in a new country, you can feel like a beginner again because you don't know what's available. So that will give you good background knowledge. So that's the three steps.
Cool. And like, this person's like, I don't know, chosen 7 generations for a reason. So is that like, if they decided a ballpark year they want to get to, would you say? I mean, how far back would that take you?
I don't know why they've chosen 7 generations. I mean, 7 generations by chance is probably a good number of generations if you're thinking of doing a DNA test. So let's say that was precisely their reason. They've done a DNA test with, for instance, Ancestry or 23andMe, all those autosomal DNA testing companies, because you can use those autosomal tests to trace back 5 or 6 generations pretty confidently and, you know, comfortably. So their 7-generation kind of remit might be because of that. Okay. So 7 generations, you could say if it's like you, your parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, 2 greats, 3 greats, 4 greats, back to your 4 times great grandparents. There is actually a French word, and I'm going to say this wrong. It's, I can't say it. Anyway, you've got 64 of these ones. Yeah? 64 times great grandparents. And it's kind of, it's a pretty cool thing if you can trace all of your 4 times great grandparents, because there's 64 of them.
Wow.
Soon adds up, doesn't it? Just across that one generation.
That's crazy. Imagine how big your tree must look if you can get that far back on all of them.
Yes, I haven't got all of mine. I've probably got a third of mine.
It's quite impressive.
And after all this time, that's not very impressive.
What sort of years are that then?
Going back, probably the mid-1700s, roughly.
Wow, that's cool. That's really cool.
It sounds cool to you, but it's not very cool. It's where everybody gets stuck because the records get harder. So not everybody, but lots of people get stuck there. And I'm similar to lots of people, and I've got stuck there too. And partly it's stuck, and partly it's okay. You have to equip yourself with new skills, new knowledge, new determination, and keep going. But I haven't done that. I've decided to go back and start building up more of the earlier generations. So back to this person, the key records, let's say we were talking about somebody in the British Isles, they're going to be wanted to look at birth, marriage and death records, the church registers of baptisms, marriages and burials, and census records. And most of these are going to be helpful for the last couple of centuries, back to the early mid 1800s. And obviously, if you've got an ancestor, like we're talking about going back seven generations, we're going to be probably going back into the early mid 1700s, but you might get some of those people who were born in the latter half of the 1700s. They could be on a census, an 1841 census, couldn't they? So all of those records could help them get back there seven generations.
Yeah, that's cool. It's terrifying me as well, just thinking about organizing that many people. That's a lot of data to sort, isn't it?
Yes, especially as that's only just your actual direct ancestors, and part of your DNA goal, which I think we mentioned earlier, is, which could be for a future week, is finding out all these siblings of all of these ancestors and building them forward, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, Nathan.
Oh, my God.
This is a full-time job.
It is a full-time job, yes. That's why it's so handy to have it on an app. You can just sneak little bits of research sessions in here and there.
I do like the app. I wish I had more knowledge so I could literally just sit on the bus and fill it in as I was just like sat on a bus. But it's good that I can have it at hand and ponder it whilst I'm out and about. It's cool.
Mm.
Or visiting relatives, I guess. It's
definitely.
Don't need to lug about a big case full of the files, which I wouldn't be able to from what my mum's got. It's far too heavy. But yeah, that's cool.
Yes. Oh, there's so many projects there. I'm not even going to put anything else. You're going to crack on with your projects, aren't you?
I am.
Fill in the gaps.
Find the missing dates if I can. And then, yeah, I will try and put a few pictures in as well, I think, if I can. I kind of like that idea.
Mm.
That'd be really cool.
Mm.
So they're my challenges.
Yeah, have a wonderful time with them.
Thank you.
See you soon then.
Talk to you later.
Bye.